Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to And Colossally, That's History, the podcast that takes an unadulterated look at the earth-shattering events, epic sagas and huge characters that have shaped motor racing history. I'm Richard Williams and I'm joined as ever by my old friend and co-host, Matt Bishop. Matt, how are you doing? Are you ready for another trip back in time?
I'm very well, thanks, Richard. And how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
That makes two of us. So yes, I'm very much looking forward to this next episode. And I'm especially excited about this episode because we're not just revisiting the past, as we always do, but also we're going to be doing some ranking, some 1 to 5 ranking, which is always fun.
That's right. On today's episode, we're going to be ranking the top 5 British drivers to have raced for Ferrari. And the listeners can probably guess why we're doing this topic.
Exactly so. And I don't know when you're going to be listening to this exactly, but we're recording it in mid-March 2024. And not only has the hysteria surrounding Lewis Hamilton's move, or mooted, or immediate, no, not mooted, but imminent, definite move from Mercedes to Ferrari for 2025 barely subsided, but we've also seen another British driver, Ollie Bearman, make his F1 debut with Ferrari at age 18, by the way. And what a fabulous debut it was too. Points first time out. So we thought, what better time to look back on the other British drivers who have raced for Ferrari in Formula One? And there's actually been quite a few of them, Richard, hasn't there?
There have been. And we make it 12, Ollie Bearman being the 12th and the youngest driver ever to make his debut in a Ferrari in a Grand Prix.
And the youngest Brit ever to make his debut in a Championship Grand Prix as well.
Yes, indeed. And that doesn't include 2 world champions and 3 who made only 1 start apiece.
Absolutely right. But anyway, as a biographer of Enzo Ferrari, and that is you, Richard, do you have a feeling for why he liked British drivers quite so much? Or on the team's front, it's rather surprising because the Brits were always his arch enemies going back all the way through the 50s and onwards.
Mm. Well, I think his relationship with British motor racing really began in the very early 50s when Tony Vandevelle, the maker of thin wall bearings and later of Van Wall racing cars, sold him some bearings for Ferrari engines and bought a Ferrari, which he renamed the Thin Wall Special and got various people to drive, up and coming, and more experienced drivers. And Enzo Ferrari and Tony Vandevelle had a pretty good relationship, I think. And through that, I think Enzo began to look at British drivers a bit more closely. And the first one he looked at very seriously, it didn't come to anything, that was Stirling Moss. But then there was Mike Hawthorn, and Hawthorn, you know, won an important race for him in 1953. And then, you know, then there were Peter Collins and then John Surtees and various others all the way through the dozen we're going to talk about.
Interesting. The Thin Wall Special. Fantastic car, actually, wasn't it?
Beautiful car.
Beautiful car.
Green Ferrari.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Why, this is a slight aside, but why was Van Wall called Van Wall, not Van de Velle?
I suppose because it was a conflation of Van de Velle and Thin Wall. And Thin Wall isn't a wonderful name for a racing car, is it really? Van Wall's a bit better. I know when I was, you know, 10 or 11, Van Wall was a great name. It seemed terrifically charismatic, as did the cars.
Yes. Well, and wonderful cars, although Stirling Moss always said they handled badly.
Yep.
He still won plenty of races in them, but he said they handled badly. Anyway, yes, you mentioned Mike Hawthorn's famous win. You're thinking about the race of the century at Reims?
I am, yeah, 1953 at Reims, when he fought it out with Juan Manuel Fangio, who was in a Maserati, up the finishing straight on the last lap and just got ahead.
And swapping the lead all the way through,
yes,
endlessly.
Yeah. And with Gonzalez close behind as well. So it was a wonderful race.
It was a wonderful race, the race of the century. There's probably a few rivals to it ever since, but that was maybe the first Formula One race of the century. You mentioned Moss, Stirling Moss. He never drove for Ferrari, but how close did he come, and what do you think would have happened if he had done?
Twice he came very close indeed. The first time was in 1951 at Bari in Puglia, in down the east coast of Italy, when they had a non-championship Formula One race. And Enzo Ferrari invited Moss to go down and drive one of his cars in this non-championship race. The year before in Bari, Moss had come second in an HWM and impressed everybody, because that was a Formula 2 car, and he'd come second to Fangio in one of the great Alfettas, which was quite an achievement. So that had marked Enzo's card, and he invited Moss down, and Moss travelled from London with his dad. They drove down, I think, through Europe, across the Alps, down Italy to Bari. Not an inconsiderable journey in 1951, in the days before Autostrada and so on. And they got there, and they found the paddock. It was a street circuit in Bari. They found where the Ferrari team had set up their garage, and there were the cars. And Moss knew he was, I think they had a 625, which was a Formula One car, and a 500, which was a Formula Two car at the time. And Moss knew he'd be driving the 500, so he went over to it and said to the mechanics, can I try it? And the mechanic said, well, what are you doing here? This isn't your car. This is Taruffi's car. They shooed him away. And it turned out there wasn't a car for him. So he was very upset, and having gone all that way. And he and his father made a vow at that point never to drive for Ferrari, that Sterling would never drive for Ferrari. So, you know, he took delight in later years in beating the Ferraris with Maseratis and Van Walls and Coopers and Lotuses. But then at the end of 1961, he was driving brilliantly, you know, in that year he'd produced two masterpieces in a Lotus at Monaco and Nürburgring to win the race against the much faster Ferraris. But he was a bit fed up of being an underdog, mechanically speaking, the whole time. So he had a meeting with Ferrari in Maranello, at which they made an agreement that he would drive a Ferrari in 1962. It would be painted in the colours of Rob Walker, who'd been entering his Lotuses and Coopers, Rob Walker, the heir to the Johnny Walker whiskey fortune. And Rob's cars, being Scottish, they were painted dark blue with a white band on the nose, like the Scottish flag. So that was what apparently was going to happen. You know, the Ferraris in 1961 had been fantastic cars. Phil Hill had been the world champion and so on. So it looked like Moss was finally going to get into a car that would win him the world championship. And he was going to drive the GTO car as well in long distance races. But then at Easter Monday, start of the 1962 season, he had his terrible accident. And Took a long time to recover from dreadful injuries and came back, tried out a car at Goodwood and decided he was going to retire. So never drove a works Ferrari, which actually was probably not such a terrible thing because having been all-conquering in 1961, the 1962 Ferrari was an absolute dog compared with the developments that Lotus and Cooper had made. So it might not have ended happily.
He might have stuck around till 1964, and then he would have been probably won Surtees championship.
Yes, that may be true. Whether he would have stayed that long, who knows? Moss didn't tend to stay anywhere very long, so he might have switched teams again. But that's in the realms of speculation.
Totally. Anyway, the long the short of it is, Moss did not race for Ferrari as mooted twice with a 10 years apart. 51 and 61. And I did like your description of when he went down to Bari and was second in an HWM Formula 2 car, beaten by an Alfetta. And just compare the names. It's such an emblem of the decade to come. England or UK versus Ferrari. Alfetta versus Hersham and Walton Motors. Anyway, I think that's some good scene setting. And I suppose I should explain how this episode will work. Richard and I have each ranked our top Ferrari drivers, British Ferrari drivers, and our lists have then been combined by our producer, Johnny. Thank you, Johnny. To form our combined ultimate top five Brits in Ferrari's ranking. So we're going to go through that list from number five to number one. But before we do, Richard, how did you approach the task and did you find it difficult?
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? It's, you know, comparing across eras is always fun, but never easy and never really definitive. I gave priority to drivers who won the world championship for Ferrari because that's what they're there to do. And if they do that, they've done their job. And I think that's what the team would have thought too. But then also drivers who made distinctive contributions, you know, whether it was the one who won the first Grand Prix after the death of Enzo Ferrari, which was obviously a very big morale-boosting thing. And that was Nigel Mansell, but we'll come to that later. So that kind of thing weighed a bit with me too. Of course, sheer speed, but there's also a question of being able to integrate within the team, coping with the politics that have always been such a wonderful part of the Ferrari scene. Where, you know, where would Formula One be without Ferrari politics? And the drivers have to deal with that. So that was a factor too.
Then and now, Ferrari, you know, primus inter pares, first amongst equals, in Formula One, much to the chagrin of Ron Dennis, with whom I used to work at McLaren. But nonetheless the case, and Ferrari still, then and now, offered, you know, advantages and guarantees and financial special treatments. Because in one sense, Ferrari is the only brand, really, to use a word that wouldn't have been used in the time, that is bigger than Formula One itself, you could argue.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously, you know, there are some other great brands, you know, Aston Martin, McLaren, Mercedes-Benz, not necessarily in a racing context bigger than Formula One itself, but Ferrari perhaps is. So anyway, I approached ranking the top five in a slightly less, maybe a little bit more emotional at times, because on the one hand, I did try to incorporate and bear in mind all the factors you've said. But the person I chose as number one, we can come to that later, I chose simply because I thought he was one of the most underrated brilliant drivers that there's ever been. But we'll come to that later. So before we get to discussing our top five, our combined top five, shall we talk briefly, just briefly, about some of the drivers who missed the top five cut?
Yes, and the first driver I wanted to talk about was a man called Mike Parks, who some of our listeners will have heard of, who arrived at Ferrari in 1963 as an engineer. He was the son of the chairman of Alvis Cars, and he'd done an apprenticeship in engineering at Roots, the Roots Group, which was Sunbeam and Hillman. And
he worked on the Hillman Imp, I believe.
I think he did, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, he did. And then he joined Ferrari as an engineer and did some sports car racing. That was a time when John Surtees was in the team, and we'll talk about Surtees a bit later. Surtees fancied himself as an engineer always. He always thought he could improve the cars, and quite a lot of the time he could. But he and Parks locked horns. So it wasn't really until Surtees left the team, having won the World Championship. He won the World Championship in 64, but then left in 66 after a row. Which Parks may or may not have had something to do with, that Parks got his chance in the Formula One team. He only had half a dozen starts in works Ferraris, but he did come second at Reims in 1966 and second at Monza behind his teammate Lodovico Scafiotti, also in 66. And then in the beginning of 67, he won the international trophy at Silverstone in a Ferrari. And then I was present, actually, when his Grand Prix career ended at Spa. I was sitting above Eau Rouge at the top of the hill there. And if you saw across the valley on the other side of the circuit, I could see his car disintegrate when it left the track and hit a bank. And he had pretty bad injuries, and that was the end of his F1 career. Ferrari wouldn't let him back into a Grand Prix car again after that. And he went on and drove sports cars and quite successfully. But then he was killed working for he was working for Lancia, and he was killed in a road crash some years later. But I think he was clearly a very talented driver. You know, his limited number of starts, you could see that he was really quick, and you could see from his sports car results. You know, he came second at Le Mans in 67 with sharing a Ferrari with Scafiotti. He was a really good driver.
I thought he was a really good driver. In fact, I ranked him number six, so just the best of the rest outside our top five. So very quick man. And I have to say, talking again about the mix of English and Italian, imagine having a lineup of Mike Parks and Ludovico Scafiotti. how perfect. I also quite ranked reasonably highly Cliff Allison.
Yep.
Not because he had in any way a glorious Ferrari career. He didn't. Or indeed Lotus career. He didn't have a glorious one of those very early in the Lotus story. But he is still a driver who has raced for Lotus and Ferrari in Formula One, which not that many people, well, as a list of them, of course, but he is one. And he was a lovely man. I met him towards the end of his life and, in fact, received a letter from him, which he posted on the morning he died.
But he was 90 or something, wasn't he?
He wasn't quite that old. I think he was more like 80.
Was he?
But he drove, by that, he would fallen on hard times. He was driving the village bus in Brough in Cumbria, where he lived, his business having not succeeded. Anyway, we're not going to talk.
Wasn't that his father's garage, which ran the school bus around the villages there?
It was, but unfortunately they built a bypass. So the garage... That didn't help business. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Mike Parks or Cliff Allison, except en passant. So, is it now time to talk about number five?
Certainly is. And that's Nigel Mansell. What was your view of Mansell, Matt?
Well, as a Ferrari driver, you know, difficult to talk about Mansell only as a Ferrari driver because, of course, you know, 31 Grand Prix victories, but 28 of them for Williams and only three for Ferrari. Nonetheless, in that time, you know, he did become beloved of the Tifosi, I think. And indeed, they called him, or at least we British journalists supposed that they actually called him Il Leone. Perhaps they did.
They did. I remember seeing that a few times in headlines in the Gazzetta dello Sport. Definitely.
Well, so he did. He did win their hearts, and he did win the first race he ever did, or Formula One race he ever did for Ferrari. which was at Jacarepaguá in Rio in 1989, Brazilian Grand Prix. And not many people have won a Grand Prix on their Ferrari debut, Fernando Alonso being one such. But yeah, he did. And at that point, I think I would have been very surprised if you told me he'd only ever win two more, since that was his 29th. No, it wasn't. Since he would, he'd already won tons for Williams, and he would win tons more for Williams after that.
Of course, that win in Rio was significant in a couple of ways. One, it came just, you know, a few months after Enzo Ferrari had died. So the team's morale was, in fact, the company's morale as a whole was not good at that point. So to have a win was a great boost for the team, I think. And, you know, they were going to go through, the team and the company were going to go through a difficult time, but that was a help. And that was in a car designed by John Barnard, who'd come up with the paddle gear shift, semi-automatic gear change with paddle shifts. And that was the debut for that particular feature at Rio, and it won, of course. And now, you know, you walk down the street and look in the windows of cars, and every fifth one probably will have paddle shifts, and that goes all the way back to that.
Absolutely, and it became de rigueur in Formula One very soon.
Very quickly it did, yeah.
And it wasn't only the death of Enzo Ferrari that the team, if you like, was reeling from, but also because the previous year it had been, you know, humiliated by McLaren, which had won famously 15 out of 16 races. You know, a horrible thing for Ferrari and a horrible thing for Enzo Ferrari. They did win one race at Monza. It was actually a 1-2. Gerhard Berger first and Michele Alboreto second. And I believe, yes, that race happened just after Enzo had died, which was also an absolute shot in the arm for the team. But nonetheless, you know, McLaren then went back to winning the rest of the races that season, and then we went to Brazil, and no Enzo, the team reeling from having been beaten very soundly by McLaren, and Cesare Fiorio in charge, someone with whom Nigel Mansell didn't get on, his teammate, a very easy person to get on with at that time, Gerhard Berger, but the following year, of course, Nigel's second year at Ferrari, Alan Prost, I always regard as the ultimate terrible teammate to have, because very quick and also very political.
Yeah, and he was coming into what was already a very politically difficult team. So, you know, clearly Prost had his priorities, which was to make it his own team and make sure it wasn't Mansell's team anymore. And I think he worked pretty hard at that. And he, you know, he won some races, and Nigel only won one more in Estoril in 1990.
He won three altogether.
He won in Rio and Hungary in 89. And then in Estoril. But it was an unhappy season for him, I think, in every way. It was very disillusioning. He'd, you know, even though the first season hadn't been easy, he'd won over the fans. You know, he was feeling he was someone who needed to feel happy and comfortable. But then along came the professor.
The professor, and I think the professor was also thinking, or the professor was thinking, once bitten, twice shy. You know, I've been Senna'd, so I'm not going to be Mansell'd. Yeah. And he made sure he wasn't.
Yeah, and Mansell was never politically adroit on the same level, for sure.
As either Prost or Senna.
No.
No. Well, I think that might be a good time to come to a break, having dealt with Nigel Mansell, the fifth greatest Brit to have driven for Ferrari in Formula One, we think.
We do.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Okay, we're going to move on to driver number four, who's a figure from the 1950s and a very glamorous and charismatic one too. Peter Collins of Kidderminster, who joined the Ferrari team in 1956. What's your feeling about Collins, Matt?
Well, I think Collins, you know, very quick, but, you know, I actually put him at number four and he ended up at number four. And look, as you say, I mean, dapper, handsome. Our friend, our mutual friend Nigel Roebuck used to say about Carlos Reutemann that he had the looks of a racing driver from Central Casting. I remember that phrase. Well, so did Peter Collins.
He certainly did, particularly for the 50s. He was a perfect 1950s figure.
And his beautiful girlfriend, then wife, Louise King.
Yep.
Who was ever present.
American actress whom he met in Miami, at, set up by Stirling Moss, and married a week later. And they were blissfully happy for the short period of time that was granted to him.
The short period of time that was granted to them, which we'll come to. And of course, he won three Grand Prix for Ferrari, two in 56, one in 58. And he was a quick man. He was a quick man. And obviously, one always lumps the two together with Hawthorne, but we'll come to Hawthorne. Let's talk a bit about the 1956 season, because, of course, it was a Fangio championship year, one of many, one of five. But it's just possible that it could have been a Collins championship year, could it not?
Yes, it could. Ferrari had quite a lot of drivers in 1956. He had Fangio, he had Collins, he had the two young Italians, Eugenio Castellotti and Luigi Musso, whose chief priority was to beat each other, I think, to be the best Italian. And Ferrari, you know, they were a fairly wild bunch and he shuffled them around from race to race. And obviously, you know, Fangio joined the team in 56 from Mercedes as world champion and established as the sort of patron of the drivers, and was expecting to win the world championship again, and that, you know, might even have been in his contract. So everything was done. Although Ferrari didn't like Fangio, didn't get on with him, but everything was done.
Was that too big for his boots or too grand?
No, it wasn't. No, I think probably his manager asked for too much money that Ferrari didn't want to pay. That might have had something to do with it. And he always said he had a tinny little voice. I don't think he liked him on a personal level either.
He wanted a basso supremo.
or a heroic tenor, maybe. Anyway, Fangio needed a bit of help to win the title in 1956. And in the end, he got it from Peter Collins, who was in, as they went to Monza for the last race of the season. And Collins was still in with a shout, and I think Moss was too, and Fangio. It was a very hot day. They were using the banked circuit as well as the road circuit, and it was chewing up the Ferrari's tyres. There were lots of crashes, lots of punctures, high speed. Fangio's steering broke at one point, and his car crashed, and he got back to the pits and needed a new car. The team manager of the time asked all the drivers, you know, when they came into the pits, would you let Fangio take over your car? Because in those days, if there were two drivers in a car, they split the points. And if Fangio got half the points, then that would be enough to make him world champion. Musso particularly refused. No, I'm not getting out. I'm an Italian racing in front of an Italian crowd at the Great Italian Circuit in an Italian car. So I'm not getting out for this Argentinian, even though he might be the world champion. So he carried on. And when Collins came in, Collins agreed, being an English gentleman, and got out. Fangio got in. And Moss was going to win the race, but then ran out of petrol, and Fangio got enough points to win the championship, thanks to Collins.
And you mentioned Musso. Obviously, Musso didn't like Hawthorne or Collins at all. And if, I think his widow, didn't she actually say, I think she did a quote saying, I hated them.
Yes. I mean, that was a couple of years later when Musso died at Reims, when he was trying to win the race. Which carried the greatest prize money. Reims, there was a much, much bigger prize pot at Reims.
Than and 100 bottles of champagne.
And 100 bottles of champagne, yeah, for pole position after winning a race. Yeah. I don't think he was so interested in the champagne. I think he needed the money, actually. He had a car dealership that was in a bit of trouble back home. And I think his girlfriend, Fiamma Bresci, felt when he was killed that Hawthorne and Collins, the Englishman, had ganged up against him. I don't think that was really true, actually, but I think in her understandably fevered imagination, that took hold. But anyway, we got a bit of ahead of ourselves there because Collins didn't win the world championship that he might have won in 56.
But he did have a very, very good season in 56. In fact, I noted that in the seven Grand Prix he raced there, it was DNF, did not finish, second, first, second, DNF, second.
Yes, well, that's in fact a much better year than Hawthorne had in 58 when he won the world championship. Collins was very unlucky that year, and he was only, I think, 25 at the time. You know, he would have, you know, he should have had a long and glorious career. And, you know, he and Moss should have been fighting it out for world championships later on, no doubt about that. But then 57, you know, was a good year for Maserati, where Fangio had gone. And then 58, Ferrari had a very good car again for Hawthorne, Collins and Musso for a while. But then Collins won it very convincingly at Silverstone, won the British Grand Prix in front of his home crowd, terrific victory. And it looked as though he was going to be one of the contenders for the title that year with Hawthorne and with Moss, who was in a Van Wall and winning races. But then at the Nürburgring, he and Hawthorne in the Ferraris were chasing Tony Brooks's Van Wall, I think. And Collins went wide at a corner and hit the bank, was thrown out, hit a tree and was killed. Very, very tragically indeed. And it was an awful time for Ferrari because Musso had just been killed and they'd lost Castellotti the year before and so on. So it was, you know, and Deportago as well the year before. It was a very dark time indeed for Ferrari.
A very dark time. And you mentioned, of course, Tony Brooks. And Tony Brooks is the driver that we have at number three of our top five. I actually made him number one.
Yeah, I had him at number five, and there's a very specific reason for that. But you tell us why you think he should have been number one.
I had him at number one simply because Stirling Moss said, and I saw it quoted, and I actually asked him, Stirling, if he would stand by this, which he did. He said, you know, Hawthorne and Collins were very quick, but not a patch on Brooks. Mm. Brooks was the driver, the British driver that I saw. Obviously, he revered Fangio. But Brooks was the one that he thought was a foeman worthy of his steel, if you like. And, you know, Brooks at Spa, the old Spa, was something to behold. I know he didn't have the career he should have had. The ex-dentist that only did 30-odd Grand Prix. But won a good proportion of them, you know, two for Ferrari and quite a few more. Was it about a few?
Two for Ferrari and four for Van Wall.
Exactly. Yep. So six out of 30-odd. Yep. Very good strike rate. And, a beautifully fluent, fast, brave driver.
Yeah, he was very, very good on quick circuits. Quite interesting in 58 for Van Wall. He won at Spa, Arvus at the Great Speed Bowl in Berlin, and Monza, all very, very high speed circuits. And then in 59, when he moved to Ferrari after Van Wall's closed operations, he won at Reims again and Arvus again. So once more, those fast circuits. So that's one of my two reservations about Brooks. The other being that although he loved road circuits, he didn't win on a street circuit. He didn't win on a really tight, slow, low-speed circuit, which is, you know, one sign of a great driver, not the only one. But he was clearly a very fast, very polished performer. But my real reservation about him as a Ferrari driver came in his last race for Ferrari in 1959, when they went to Sebring for the second ever American Grand Prix on the old airfield circuit at Sebring. There were three drivers in with a chance of the championship. He was one, Moss was another, and Brabham was the third. And it was a very complicated series of equations that, you know, for each one to win the title at that race. Brooks certainly had to win, and Moss and Brabham had to come no higher than second or third, something like that. Anyway, it's complicated.
No lower.
No lower, that's right. Sorry. Yeah. He qualified third in the days when there was a three-car front row, but then got bounced off to the second row when Harry Schell, at the end of practice, turned in a very quick time. It wasn't until some time later that it was discovered that Schell had actually cut off part of the circuit. He'd found a shortcut at this airfield, and he'd missed off the entire straight and cut his time by 6 seconds or something. Started from the front row, and I think he was eighth at the end of the first lap. But what happened on that first lap, it was very bad luck for Brooks, because on that first lap, he was rammed up the rear by his young German teammate, Wolfgang von Trips. And he could have carried on, but he'd promised his young wife, his lovely young Italian wife, that if there was any damage to his car, he would always have it checked. He'd had two really bad accidents, one in 56 in the British Grand Prix with a BRM and one at Le Mans with an Aston, I think in 57, with cars that already were carrying some form of mechanical fault or damage. And he promised his wife that if that happened again, he would have it checked and he wouldn't race until he was satisfied with the car's integrity. So much to the irritation of the Ferrari team management, he came in at the end of that first lap to have the car checked over. Took 2 minutes to check it. He got back into the race and drove like a demon afterwards, but couldn't finish any higher than third. And so didn't win the championship, which was looked on with great disfavor back at Maranello.
I can imagine it certainly was, particularly by Enzo Ferrari himself. But it gave Jack Brabham his first world championship and the first rear-engined world championship.
It did, and Brabham won it by pushing the car over the line because he'd run out of petrol 400 yards from the finish.
Still,
those were the days.
Still rear-powered because...
Yeah, he wasn't pulling it.
No, he wasn't pulling it. Anyway, I'm happy with Tony Brooks ending up at number three. I made him number one simply because of his extraordinary prowess. As you say, the old Spa, Nürburgring, Monza, fast circuits, Reims, and because of what Stirling Moss said. But actually, as a Ferrari driver, rather than taking his career in the hole, I'm very happy with number three.
Very good. And now it's time for another ad break. So we'll be back in a moment to discuss who we ranked at number two on our list and who has claimed the title of Ferrari's best British driver.
So we're now down to the final two, number one and number two. So who is number two? Well, I'll tell you who number two is. It's Mike Hawthorne. Mike Hawthorne, the other half of Mon Ami Mate, and obviously won a world championship for Ferrari in 1958, won only three Grand Prix for Ferrari, though, in 53, 54, and 58. But we can talk a lot about Mike Hawthorne, you know, green jacket, bow tie, looked 50 when he was 26.
Never seen without without a pint of beer in his hand.
Frothing ale.
Yeah, yeah, flat cap.
All of that.
Yes. Born in Mexborough in Yorkshire in 1929, brought up in Farnham in Surrey, where his father, Leslie, who was a motorcycle racer, I think, had a garage.
A very distant relation of mine worked with him and worked with him on his early cars, not Ferraris, but before he...
The Cooper Bristol,
yes,
Rileys.
Cooper Bristols, yeah, and the old Riley. Yeah. Yes, Huey Sewell. Hugh Sewell, Huey in our family. And he was married to my grandmother's first cousin. Actually, she married three times. But anyway, so one of them was Huey Sewell. And he appears, Huey Sewell does get mentioned in Mike Hawthorne's two books, which I think are quite good books.
They are good, yeah. Mm. Challenge Me, The Race, and Champion Year.
Precisely so. Precisely.
Highly recommended.
Highly recommended.
If you can find them.
Anyway, there he was, frothing ale, green jackets, bow ties, looked old, actually quite quick.
Yeah, very quick. He made an impression. His dad bought him a Cooper Bristol in the early 50s. And in the 1952 British Grand Prix, which was run at a time when the World Championship was run for 2 litre Formula 2 cars, he came third, which was pretty impressive in a field of very hot Ferraris and Maseratis. And I think that made an impression on Ferrari, certainly, because he was in the Ferrari team for the next year in 1953, when he won that marvelous race at Reims, that epic finish, beating Fangio and Gonzalez by a whisker at the end of a really torrid contest. And that actually, another element of that result was that it ended Alberto Ascari's streak of 9 wins in a row for Ferrari. But it continued the run for Ferrari, because that's who Hawthorne was driving for. But it prevented Maserati from snapping that streak, at least. And it was a big thing.
Of course, in those years, it was the Formula One World Championship, but Formula Two cars.
Yeah.
Formula 2 cars.
2 litre cars. Mm. And Hawthorne did have a fantastic season. He finished every race. He was second 3 times, third 4 times, and he was 5th and 6th. So, you know, never out of the points. It was a terrific, terrific performance. And in a very good Ferrari, the 500, you know, which had taken Ascari to 2 championships in a row. Following season, he wasn't so lucky because they came up with the Squalo and the Super Squalo, which was not exactly super. He did win a race in Spain at Pedralbes in Barcelona, but that was the end of that run. And I think at that point he decided he wanted to spend more time at home and driving British cars.
In the pubs of Surrey.
In the pubs of Surrey, yes, yes.
And he did do that, and he raced for Vanwall and
BRM.
Yeah. And but then he did return. We're talking about Ferrari. Of course, he did then return to Ferrari. How did that come about, Richard?
Well, Collins might have had something to do with it, I would have thought. As you mentioned the Mon Ami Mate thing earlier. They were pals. They went around together. They did the things that young men do together when they've got a bit of money and scope for enjoying themselves. Mon Ami Mate came about. It was a line in a cartoon, a bubble in a cartoon, where this character referred to a friend of his as "Mon ami, mate," and they picked that up and they used it about each other, and it became the title of a very good joint biography of the two by the late Chris Nixon. "Mon ami, mate," a very highly recommended book.
Very highly recommended. Yeah. If you can find it.
If you can find it, like a lot of these books. But it is really good. So Hawthorne was back in a Ferrari for 58 with Collins and Luigi Musso, and a very good car, the Dino 246, lighter, quicker, very, very handy little car indeed. A bit more agile than the Van Wall, which was being driven by Moss and Brooks and Stuart Lewis Evans, which was not an agile car, but was very quick. Anyway, they were well matched. But Hawthorne won only one race that season at Reims again, whereas Moss won three, and I think Brooks won three, but Hawthorne racked up the points. Collins was killed, Musso was killed during the season.
Lewis Evans was killed at the end.
Lewis Evans was killed at the end, although not in contention for the championship. But, right. You know, by the end, when they went to Casablanca for the last race of the season, it was between Moss and Hawthorne. And Moss did everything he needed, everything he could do. He won the race and he got a point for the fastest lap in the time when that's when you got a point for that. And he needed Hawthorne to do no better than coming third. And that nearly happened. In second place was Hawthorne's young, new Ferrari teammate, Phil Hill, who did the decent thing the number two should do and let Hawthorne by. And that won Hawthorne the title, having won only one race in the year. And having been given back some points a little early, a couple of races earlier, by Moss's chivalry, when the stewards in Portugal, the stewards tried to disqualify Hawthorne, but Moss spoke on his behalf at the tribunal immediately after the race and got his points reinstated. And that was also enough to win Hawthorne the title.
So we've had an act of chivalry from Peter Collins and another one just now described by you by Stirling Moss. Mm. I think of all the championships that Stirling Moss did not win, because he came third a bunch of times and second a bunch of times.
Yep.
58 is the one he really should have won, and kind of with respect to Mike Hawthorne, I always kind of almost see it as his year, what really should have been his championship year.
Yes, it showed the number of wins and his general superiority, but that's Moss for you. He didn't win. And then poor Hawthorne, having won his title, retired to consternation back at Maranello. He retired very soon after that last race, and Ferrari were not expecting it at all. They thought they would have the world champion going with them going into the next season.
Well, he had a kidney disease, didn't he?
He did. And it was debilitating, and it had been for some years. You know, he had off days, and when he had an off day, it was usually because of that. So I think that was a big factor. And he'd lost his best mate, you know, Collins as well. I think that was another factor. And they had a garage business that, you know, he was going to look after. But then, unhappily, a few weeks after the end of the season, he was driving his Jaguar Mark II to a meeting in London, came out onto the A3.
Was he not racing Rob Walker?
Yeah, well, he came out onto the A3, and Rob Walker was also on his way to London in his gullwing Mercedes 300 SL. Hawthorne, you know, this was 1959. Hawthorne didn't like the idea of being beaten by a German car in any environment at all. So it's pretty clear that they had a bit of a dice going down the hill of the Guildford Bypass. And it was it had been raining a bit, so the road was wet. He went off in the Jaguar, hit a tree and killed himself, which was an awful end to his world championship.
An absolutely awful end. But anyway, that's our number two driver. And I'm sure quite a few people must have worked out who our number one driver is. And in fact, I didn't make him number one, but I ranked him highly. But you did make him number one, Richard. Why?
Well,
we're talking about John Surtees, by the way. We're talking about John Surtees.
Yeah, Surtees did two things that that make him, to my mind, an outstanding Ferrari driver. One, he came in and helped the team recover from a very difficult situation that it was in through his enthusiasm, his ability. And to some extent, his engineering knowledge. But then, having won the World Championship, he left the team in acrimony after an enormous amount of politicking. And that's another, you know, mark of distinction for a Ferrari driver, in my view. You know, he had 30 Grand Prix in a Ferrari, and he won four of them. And that was enough to win the title.
And four non-championship races as well.
He did. That's absolutely true. Yeah, which had some significance in those
days. They did. And I love the little list, because just imagine how glamorous these four non-championship races that he won for Ferrari must have been. You know, Kyle Army. I mean, whatever your views of apartheid, you know, early 60s going to Kyle Army must have been the most extraordinary, glamorous thing to do. And then Pergusa. And Syracuse twice.
Yeah.
You know, there we are. That's a Ferrari tally, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I went to Syracuse once.
Did you?
And went looking for the old circuit. It was on the outskirts of a beautiful town. And there was a policeman hanging around. So I said, can you tell me where the old circuit went, where the start and finish and where the pits were? And he pointed down the road, and I said, oh, I'll just take a stroll down. He said, that's where the sex workers are. He didn't use that term, but that was the burden of what he was saying. So I didn't, in fact.
You did not, even on the basis of important research for your books?
I'm afraid that's where I drew the line in terms of research. But that was a fabulous race. Syracuse Grand Prix, never a championship race.
Never.
But it was always really interesting.
Well, he won it. Surtees won it twice for Ferrari. And, of course, he won a championship Ferrari as 1964, as you say.
Yeah.
And it is worth just saying, you know, he was a magnificent motorsport exponent. I'm going to say driver and rider.
The only man ever to win the world championship on two wheels and on four wheels. Nobody.
Absolutely. And you know, he won Grand Prix not only for Ferrari, but also for Cooper and Honda.
Yep.
So he was something of an engineer driver.
Yeah, he was. And he came into Ferrari for the 1963 season when they'd had just an absolute disaster in 1962. There'd been a big row at the end of the brilliant 1961 season when some of the engineers and senior managers complained that Ferrari's wife had been interfering too much, that she'd been, you know, hanging around checking their invoices and, you know, what payments had been made and making suggestions which were not exactly helpful. And Ferrari sacked them and then tried to unsack them, but couldn't. They all stayed out. And there were some very senior people like Carlo Chitti, the chief designer, for instance. Ferrari had to promote a lot of people who, you know, probably weren't ready. And 62 was a disaster, complete disaster, a terrible car, terrible morale. But then they got Surtees in. And now Surtees was very well known in Italy because his motorcycling world championships had been won on MV Agusta, the Italian team.
And let's just say he was an absolutely brilliant rider.
He was a fantastic rider. He certainly was. And he was already known in Italy as Il Grande John, Big John. Particularly big, but his exploits certainly were. And he was already a figure when he got to Ferrari. So he wasn't some meek little person just kind of coming in. And because they'd been having a lot of problems with the car, he thought that he could help on the engineering side a bit. And their new young chief designer was a young guy called Mauro Forghieri, you know, who was destined to become one of the legends of Ferrari. But then he was right at the beginning. And in Surtees' first season, he won one Grand Prix at the Nürburgring. And, you know, the car was improving. And then for 1964, the car was very good indeed. And he won at the Nürburgring again and at Monza, you know, which is the great race for Ferrari to win, of course, in front of the home support. And he won the title. Although, funnily enough, I'm sure you know this story, the last race of the season in America, the Ferraris weren't red.
Not NART.
NART, North American Racing Team.
Yeah.
Because Ferrari had had one of his usual rows with organizers. And he said, I'm not sending a Scuderia Ferrari car. But his mate, Luigi Canetti, who was his American representative, talked him into sending the cars as long as they were painted in the American colors of white and blue.
When I see that, because he ran number 7 in that race.
Yep.
And I always think of Moss, because he probably would have run number 7 in a blue and white car.
Yep.
If he'd ever had a Rob Walker Ferrari.
That is true. How very poignant, I think that would be. So Surtees won his title in a blue and white Ferrari. That was a big thing. That was a little bit like Schumacher coming in decades later and reviving the team. You know, that happens at Ferrari from time to time. The driver can come in and galvanize, you know, the team when it's on its
Schumacher,
balance.
As you say, louder, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, he did fall. He was a bit of a curmudgeon as well, wasn't he?
He was a difficult man. Yeah.
He had his own Formula One team, Surtees, the drivers used to find him tricky. Anyway, I interrupted. Carry on.
Yeah, no, I think it was his way or no way quite a lot of the time. Mm. And thereby lay the seeds of his downfall at Ferrari. It's a complicated story. And Mike Parks, the English engineer, is thought to have played a part in it because he wanted to take part in the development of the cars, and you know he butted heads with Surtees over that. But then Surtees started driving a Lola sports car. He'd sort of been given permission to do that, although Ferrari. Formula One drivers usually drove Ferrari sports cars as well. But he'd been given permission to drive in American racing in a Lola. And it was sort of spread about the Ferrari works that this Lola had a lot of ideas which appeared to have been taken off the latest Ferrari sports car. And maybe Surtees was playing a double game. I think that's a bit unlikely myself. I think, there's something also a bit naive about Surtees. But anyway, that's what happened. And then he had a really bad accident in America in the Lola and really hurt himself. So that put him out for a bit. And that, you know, Ferrari never liked his drivers getting injured and being unavailable. That was not, you know, didn't get them a tick in his book. But he came back, and then there was a row over, he was supposed to be racing at Le Mans, and there was a row over which car he was in, or indeed whether he was going to be in at all. And he had a row with Eugenio Dragoni, the team manager, and stormed out. And that was the end of his relationship with Ferrari, at which point Mike Parks stepped in.
That was 66, wasn't it?
66.
And then I think the last race of the year, he went off and raced a Cooper in Mexico, and won.
Yep.
And a fifth car. Yep. I think there were 4 or 5 Coopers in that race. Yep. And here's an anorak fact, as I like to sometimes call them. The fourth or the fifth Cooper was run by local driver Moises Solana. And they flew out a 19-year-old mechanic to work on that. Young Mr. Ron Dennis. And the rest is colossally history.
And that's where he began, with Moises Solana.
He did. Who, by the way,
terrific.
Another anorak fact, is one of the few people later in a hill climb to die in a McLaren.
Really?
Though obviously Ron was not involved in that. Mm. Anyway.
There we are. I should say, actually, that Surtees' last Grand Prix for Ferrari was at Spa in 66. And it was a brilliant win in the race. It might have been his finest win in Formula One. So, you know, there was no question of him going out because he wasn't good enough or anything.
And as I say, he went on and won in a coupe.
Yeah, indeed. He was just a brilliant driver. I remember at the beginning of the 60s when he made the transition from motorbikes and he started in Formula Junior. And he was quick straight away. You know, it was really obvious. And he was a throwback to people like Nuvolari, who'd begun on motorbikes and made the very easy transition for them to cars.
There were a few. Berra was another.
Yep, there were a few.
Obviously Hailwood, but he was more bikes.
Yeah. And it's a bit surprising that there haven't been more in recent years. You know, you might have expected Valentino Rossi to have ended up in a Ferrari.
He did a test or two.
He did. And Johnny Cecotto came over from bikes to his brilliant bike
You
rider.
Could say Damon Hill.
You could indeed. Let's say Damon Hill.
Let's say Damon Hill.
Indeed. A world champion who began on bikes. And that feels like a good time to say, and colossally, that's history. We'll be back next week with another in-depth discussion about a different topic. But in the meantime, if you're enjoying the show, and we very much hope that you are, please do follow or subscribe to the feed so you never miss an episode. Or even better, tell a friend about it if you think they'd enjoy it.
And if you want to get in touch with us or dispute our top five British Ferrari drivers, which entirely you're welcome to do, you can drop us a line on podcasts@the-race.com, or you can drop Richard or me a message on, well, they call it X, but let's call it Twitter. I'm @TheBishF1, and Richard is @RWilliams1947. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
And colossally, that's history.
The Athletic.